Chapter 31, A Dream Come True. August came and went, and still the planning permission did not come. The temple property was unlivable. Betterton Street had long since been sold, and we were all living in scattered apartments as close as we could to Berry Place. When we received an indication from Srila Prabhupada that it was better if we all lived together, Shamsundar found us an unexpected source of temporary accommodation, John Lennon and Yoko Ono's estate, Tittenhurst, an 85-acre property near Ascot Racecourse that had previously belonged to the Chocolate Baron family, Cadbury. The arrangement was that we could live in the servants' quarters free of charge in exchange for doing renovation work on the estate, peeling off paint, varnishing wood, cleaning up the grounds, and weeding the fields and gardens. Prior to our arrival, the work had been done by John's American friends, a couple named Dan and Jill, who now took on the role of supervising us in addition to working themselves. Presumably, this living arrangement had more than a little to do with the fact that we were now Apple recording artists. Our 45 was released in the first week of September, just 10 days before Srila Prabhupada was finally going to be arriving in London. The sleeve featured a photo of us with our musical instruments and said Radha Krishna Temple in large letters across the bottom. Although we hadn't planned it, we quickly became called the Radha Krishna Temple Band. Described as Indian Gospel by the New Musical Express, the record hit the British charts almost immediately and climbed to number 11. In other countries, reportedly in Japan and Yugoslavia, it reached number 1. Consequently, when we finally welcomed Srila Prabhupada to England on September 11th, we did so in a way that was grander than we had ever imagined. Generations of Gaudiya Vaishnavas had dreamed of presenting Krishna consciousness in English, and for them that had meant bringing it to England, the center of the empire of which India was a colony. Prabhupada's own spiritual master had requested many of his disciples to speak and write about Krishna in English, and his father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, had sent literature to libraries in England. Now, as Prabhupada touched down at London's Heathrow Airport, the Hare Krishna mantra was being played and sung all over the country, and the faces of Krishna devotees were plastered across the walls of the London Underground train system. Krishna consciousness had truly arrived in England. Things were gaining serious momentum in the UK, and several devotees had come to England from the States to help us. So we were able to greet Prabhupada with a large party of devotees, Apple officials, and media personnel. As the 707's door opened, and Prabhupada made his way down the portable stairway, a few men ran out onto the slick macadam and bowed down before him in the puddles. The rest of us watched from behind a wall of glass that was fogged with condensation from our breathing. The uniformed police escort waiting for Prabhupada at the bottom of the stairway stared impassively at the muddy imprints and small pieces of gravel that studded the devotees' otherwise spotlessly white robes. While the other passengers were herded away to buses bound for the immigration hall, Prabhupada was greeted by a plump, smiling immigration officer who took him aside and stamped his passport, thereby sparing him from the long lines. Finally, flanked by the official and the police escort, he walked through the glass door and into our midst. Our faces smudged the heavy gray carpet as we bowed down to offer our respects. When I stood up, Prabhupada was grinning widely, looking into the face of each devotee who had come to greet him. "Where is Gurudas?" he asked as someone placed a fluffy carnation garland around his neck. "Waiting for you at John Lennon's," I said. "We'll be staying there for the next few weeks." "This John Lennon, he is George Harrison's friend?" Prabhupada asked. "Yes." Apple personnel ushered us to the large VIP room where they had arranged a reception and press conference. Prabhupada was directed to sit on a small cushion next to a tall brass vase of flowers holding a large bouquet of orange, red, pink, and yellow blooms, lilies, delphiniums, and roses. The devotees stood watching, slightly bewildered, while a pack of photographers in dark suits and ties clustered at the back of the room and circled in for the killer shot. The photographers were accompanied by a gang of reporters, Fleet Street hacks after hard-hitting, sensational news and photos. Prabhupada reached into his bag, retrieved his kartala hand symbols, and began to sing the Hare Krishna mantra in the same simple melody that we sang on our 45. The lounge came alive as the devotees sang the response, and some stood to dance, and began to sway to the rhythm of Prabhupada's chiming kartals. A group of middle-aged Indian female airport workers in Punjabi suits poked their heads around the corner of the door, smiled, and chatted excitedly to one another. Even a few of the Fleet Street crowd managed to smile. Having Prabhupada here at last made all the wet, dismal days worth the trouble. Flashbulbs popped, and I saw fuzzy bright spots wherever I looked. The chant ended, and the reporters converged on Prabhupada, shoving us out of the way. "Is this your first time in England?" one of them asked. "Yes," Prabhupada answered, "first time." "What have you come here to teach?" another asked. His voice was insolent and challenging. "I am trying to teach what you have all forgotten," Prabhupada said. "And what is that?" "That is God," Prabhupada said in a loud, bold voice, his statement laced with conviction of a lifelong devotee. There was a short pause. It was the first time I'd seen a reporter look stumped. Prabhupada 1, Fleet Street 0. "Some of you are saying there is no God," Prabhupada continued. "Some of you are saying God is dead, and some of you are saying God is impersonal or void. Any nonsense can come to me. I shall prove that there is God. It is a challenge to the atheistic people. There is God. As we are sitting here face to face, you can see God face to face. Do you plan to meet George Harrison while you're in England?" "Yes, if he would like. I will meet with him," Prabhupada said. "I can meet with anyone who is interested in serving Krishna." "Are you his guru?" "I am no one's guru. I am servant, not master." Again, the reporters looked disconcerted. The movement had spread dramatically in the past 12 months, and Prabhupada was now often interviewed by reporters. He had visited New York, Montreal, West Virginia, Seattle, San Francisco, New Mexico, Los Angeles, Hawaii, Buffalo, Boston, Columbus, and Hamburg. Temples were established in France, Italy, Holland, Malaysia, Australia, New Zealand, India, Costa Rica, Brazil, Argentina, and many Indian cities. Numerous media interviews lay ahead, and I could see Srila Prabhupada's expertise in dealing with reporters. He possessed deftness without a hint of artifice. When the press conference ended, Prabhupada was driven in a white Rolls Royce to Tittenhurst. We had set up the best part of the servants' quarters for him, a relatively large warm room with a small south-facing window that would provide some natural light for him to work on his translating during the day. We planned that he would stay there with Purushottam, his assistant, who had come with him from the States. Shamsundar and I followed behind in the red pickup and immediately joined Gurudas in Prabhupada's room to explain how we had come to stay in John Lennon's place. "And John Lennon organized this airport meeting?" Prabhupada asked after we explained the arrangement of our lodging at Tittenhurst. "Not him personally," I said. "The Beatles company, Apple, arranged everything. It's part of the promotion for the record." "I see," Prabhupada said. "How is it selling, the record?" "Well, it sold 70,000 today," I answered. Prabhupada opened his eyes in wide astonishment. "Oh, very big business," he exclaimed. "Yes, but we don't get much money from it," Gurudas said. "Our contract is set up so that most of the money goes to Apple. But whatever we get, we will put into the new temple." It had taken a year to bring him here, and he was sending a third of our team away on the very day he arrived. I imagined Janaki and me living alone in Oxford. No income, no temple, no deities, no devotees, no Prabhupada, only the drizzly gray streets of a conservative English university town populated by intellectuals who wouldn't take us seriously. Prabhupada continued to smile. The conversation veered away from Oxford, but the venerable name hung in the air like a challenge from an erudite philosopher. "Prabhupada is a dreamer," I thought to myself. "But his dreams are coming true." I thought of the dilapidated windmill in San Francisco and wondered what would have happened if I'd tried to pursue that dream. I thought of the first Ratha Yatra in the States and how it happened because Prabhupada had dreamed of it taking place outside of India. Prabhupada was obviously not going to let us rest on our laurels in England. And though I knew I wasn't up to starting a temple in Oxford, I could see that his mission would not be complete without a center in the English-speaking world's most prestigious institution of higher learning.